We return now to more of my conversation with UC Davis historian Alan Davis about the life, ideas, and writings of Thomas Paine. I think you mentioned earlier the word utopian, and you write in your introduction that Thomas Paine cast the American struggle in utopian and universal terms. What do you mean here?
Well, he is laying out, he's asking Americans to fight not for something that once existed or something that existed somewhere else in the world. He's asking them to fight for a dream of a republic in which common people would be equal with gentlemen, in which common people would have every opportunity to rise and to accumulate property and accumulate status. So he's describing something that could be if people shared his dream. And so that's utopian. It's asking people to pursue something that's not currently existing, but something that's a vision of a better future.
To what extent did he think that an American republic, if established, could inspire others in other nations?
Yes, he's very much of the belief. He wants to tell Americans, you are not fighting just for yourselves. You are fighting for the entire world. Because he had the perception that liberty was not advancing in the world. On the contrary, it was retreating. He saw it as retreating in Britain. He thought of Britain as having had a freer government in the past than it had by 1775 and 1776. But he thought that Americans could reverse that trend in the world by establishing a republic and setting it up as an example for the rest of the world. He thought that if America succeeded in its revolution and established a republic, that the rest of the world would notice this, and common people would then demand to have their own republics wherever they lived in the world.
And Paine believes strongly in freedom and equality, and as you write in this introduction, there have been various advocates for one or the other over the years. Delineate for us what Paine meant by liberty or freedom on the one hand and equality on the other. What was he thinking?
Well, he primarily believes in what Americans would call equality of opportunity, which is not controversial in America. But he believed that equality of opportunity would lead to a more equal distribution of property. That if common people were not oppressed by wealthy and titled elites, aristocrats, and by bishops of an established church, if they could free themselves from those elites and were free to pursue their own occupations, that they would, through exchange with each other, would over time tend to equalize property. And therefore, when you had property more equalized, it would be impossible for any group of people who held superior wealth to dominate over the entire society. So he believes in equality of opportunity because he believed that it would lead to a greater equality in the distribution of education and of property.
Poor people and common folk, how dedicated, how devoted was he to those people and their possibilities, their potential for advancement in society?
Well, he always thought of himself as a common person, and the vast majority of people living in either Britain or America were common people. They were not gentlemen. They were people who worked with their hands. They were farmers, or they were mechanics and artisans. And these were Paine's people, and he devoted his entire life to trying to uplift them, to try to assist them, to try to provide them with a structure of government that would not exploit them, but would provide them with the opportunity to practice their talents and to get ahead in life. And he hoped that through this type of freedom that it would produce greater equality.
So the pamphlet Common Sense was published on January 10th, 1776. How did it sell?
It's the first great American bestseller other than the Bible. the Bible is a long-term steady seller in American history, but I think it's safe to say that no book or pamphlet up till 1776 sold more copies in a single year than did Paine's Common Sense. It just made a sensation, and it reached far beyond the 150,000 copies that were sold because it was so widely reprinted in the newspapers, and it was read aloud and passed around in taverns and on street corners, so that many Americans who were not literate became very familiar with Paine's arguments in Common Sense.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. Alan Taylor joins me by phone. He teaches history at UC Davis. He's a visiting professor currently at the University of Richmond. And he's got a new book out called The Civil War of 1812. We are talking about the introduction he wrote to a new edition of Thomas Paine's Common Sense. What argument does Paine make, I think it's especially in the appendix to the text, about the advisability of religious leaders getting involved in political disputes, about the appropriateness of mingling religion and politics?
Well, he does himself, in Common Sense, mingle religion and politics. He uses the Bible and biblical passages in order to justify his critique of monarchy. So Paine is not, at that point in his career, troubled by a mixture of religion and republicanism, but he will become much more concerned about religion in his later writings, particularly The Age of Reason, which he published in the 1790s, which is a blistering critique of organized Christianity. And he regarded the sort of professional ministers or priests, bishops, as parasites on the labor of common people. And this, in a way, reflects the ripening of his ideas as a Quaker, because Quakers were a faith that had rejected any kind of professional clergy. And Paine becomes very troubled later in his life, particularly when he's involved in the French Revolution of the 1790s, with religious elites as well as aristocracies.
Although near the end of Common Sense, he does, I think he's addressing certain claims made by certain Quaker leaders, and he does write that it tends to the, well, I'm reading here, it tends to the decrease in reproach of all religion, whatever, and is of the utmost danger to society to make it a party in political disputes. So he does seem at that point to have at least a fledgling interest in warning religious leaders from certain political matters, political discourses.
Well, he is specifically addressing that at the Quakers. It troubled Paine that the Quakers in Pennsylvania were not enthusiastic about the Revolution. And he wanted them to essentially butt out of the political discussion. Now, he's not addressing that to the many religious leaders in the colonies who were forthrightly supporting resistance to British rule, such as the Presbyterians. So it's not a categorical rejection of all religious participation in political discourse. It's targeted at the Quakers for opposing resistance.
Many conservatives today have seized upon Paine's characterization of government as a necessary evil. Was Paine anti-government?
He's anti-aristocratic government. He is in favor of a government in which the common people will be in control. And toward the end of his life, particularly in his last major publication called Agrarian Justice, he is in favor of a republic in which common people will use the power of the government to redistribute land and to provide education for everyone and to provide old age pensions for people. So this is not the kind of government that conservatives have in mind. So when they latch a hold of pain as one of the sources for their ideas, it's relying very much on his earlier writings and on a very selective reading of those earlier writings.
Common Sense, as I mentioned, comes out in January 1776. When did public opinion shift such that a majority, a solid majority of colonists wanted an actual Declaration of Independence?
Well, Paine plays a leading role in changing the minds of a majority of Americans. When Common Sense appeared in January of 1776, people were, by all accounts, not yet prepared to declare independence or to establish republics. That's pretty clearly changed by June, when Congress is considering a Declaration of Independence. And most of the observers who write about the quickness of this change identified Paine's Common Sense as the number one reason that most Americans had become prepared for independence, union, and a republic.
To what extent was the language of the Declaration of Independence influenced by Common Sense?
Well, what Common Sense sets out to do, first and foremost, is to shatter Americans' respect and reverence for the king. The king had been the great symbol of the union of the empire and had been the great object of affection by people who belonged to the empire. Colonists had enthusiastically celebrated the king's coronation, the king's annual birthday. There were many places, streets, taverns throughout the colonies named for the king. The king was highly regarded. And so Paine understood that Americans were not going to achieve their independence unless they lost their respect for the king. So he devoted at least half of Common Sense to just hammering against the king and against the concept of monarchy in its entirety. Now, when we go to the Declaration of Independence, there's this wonderful, evocative opening paragraph, which is highly philosophical. It's the words that Americans know so well. But the balance of it, the great majority that follows in the Declaration of Independence, is a bill of indictment against the king. It lists many items in which the king has transgressed against American liberty and has victimized Americans through warfare in the preceding year. And so the Declaration of Independence very much picks up on Paine's idea that you've got to demolish reverence for the king in order to achieve independence, republicanism, and union.
Paine has a withering critique in Common Sense of hereditary succession, right? This idea that someone born into a royal family becomes king by right. In what ways did he see that as utterly irrational?
Well, he just looked at the people who'd had been monarchs in different European countries and said that indeed you find that greatness does not pass down, that there are no shortage of people who are essentially brutes and fools.
And he says, he argues that something happens to somebody who assumes or is about to assume the throne. What happens to them and their ability to connect with ordinary people and their attitude toward their position?
Well, if you assume that God has chosen you to rule because of the accident of who your parents were and when you were born because you were the firstborn in the family, if you believe that, then you are not going to feel much of a connection to your fellow human beings and not feel a sort of humility and a respect for their opinions.
That's Alan Taylor. He is a professor of history at UC Davis. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Alan has written an introduction to a new edition of Thomas Paine's famous pamphlet, Common Sense. He is also author of William Cooper's Town, Power and Persuasion on the Frontier of the Early American Republic, and of the new book, The Civil War of 1812, American Citizens, British Subjects, Irish Rebels, and Indian Allies. We have a link to a couple of Alan Taylor's books, including Thomas Paine's Common Sense, on our website, againstthegrain.org. Resolutions for each of the 13 states had to be written, and you said earlier that Paine did not want a governor to exist in those states. What did Paine and his allies want the state constitutions to say and to provide for?
Well, he wanted governments to be as simple as possible. He felt the more simple a government was in its institutional framework, the more like opinion, and the easier it would be for common people to understand. So his ideal government for one of these new states would be to have one house of the legislature, not two houses, but one, and not to have a governor, but instead to have this one house of the legislature to appoint a committee of its members who would collectively exercise the functions of the executive. He said, if you make your Republican government that simple, it will be highly responsive to what the people want, and the people will understand it and will be able to exercise their influence on that new government much better than if you were to have a complex structure, say one which had two legislatures and which would have a separate governor with a veto power. That was a form of the republic which most states opted for, the more complex model. It was the model that John Adams championed. And it's the model that ultimately the U.S. Constitution that we're under now opted for. But Paine preferred a much more radical form of a republican state government, one which was simpler and had a single house of the legislature to express the wishes of the people.
And who did he think ought to have the right to vote and to hold office, and to what extent did that differ from conventional ways of thinking?
Well, the conventional way of thinking was that you needed to have a reasonably substantial stake in society, which meant you had to own enough property to employ yourself and your family. And most Americans met that standard. That's the standard of you own your own small farm or you own your own small shop. But a substantial number of free people did not own their own farm or their own shop, particularly in the cities. And for Paine, that was a problem. And he wanted common people who paid any tax of any sort. Now, by common people, he meant men, so he wasn't so far advanced in his thinking that he was prepared for women to have equal political rights. But then almost no one of that generation was so prepared. But he felt that all free men who paid any kind of tax at all, or who served in the militia, and every able-bodied man in the state was supposed to serve in a militia, that those people ought to be able to vote and hold office.
At some point, and really this debate has gone on since the founding of this nation, this question of the power of the states versus the power of the federal government, where did Paine weigh in on the question of whether the new nation would be decentralized such that states would hold much of the power, most of the power, or whether it would have a stronger national government?
Paine, who was in the Continental Army, after Common Sense, he joins the Continental Army. He is aware of just what a problem state sovereignty was, that you had these 13 bickering states, none of which was doing its fair share of supporting the army. And so soldiers were suffering at places like Valley Forge because state governments were letting them down. And almost anybody who served in the Continental Army, and especially George Washington, came out of that experience saying, save me from the state governments. And what these people wanted was a strong national government So this was something that Washington and other people worked very hard for. Now, what's interesting about Paine is that this pursuit of a strong national government was a conservative position in the 1780s. People like Washington or Alexander Hamilton were relatively conservative. And most radicals at that time were favoring state sovereignty, people like Jefferson. But Paine is a person who, while he was a radical in favoring more simple state governments and a broad right to vote, was a strong, strong nationalist. And this was because of his wartime experience.
And finally, Paine returned to America in 1801. He spent many years in Europe, including France. How was he received upon his return, and what did he do that alienated Paine from former allies like Thomas Jefferson?
There were a lot of Americans who were troubled by some of Paine's later writings, in particular, The Age of Reason. The Age of Reason, with its attack on the Bible, Paine had become such a complete rationalist that he could not subscribe to a faith that hinged upon miracles. And he also did not want to support any kind of church establishment. And so he wrote The Age of Reason to attack scriptural revelation with its emphasis on miracles and any kind of church establishment. Well, this was more than a lot of Americans were prepared for. And many people who had been great supporters of Paine, great supporters of common sense, were themselves devout Christians. And they just could not accept Age of Reason. So he's a much more controversial figure when he comes back. Second thing is, Paine had published a couple of short essays which had been highly critical of George Washington, who was president during the 1790s. And this had troubled a great number of Americans for whom Washington was their great hero. So when he arrives in America, probably about half of the people still remembered who Paine had been and were grateful for what he had done and were prepared enthusiastically to receive him. But the other half of Americans had decided that he had gone too far and regarded his return as unwelcome.
Alan Taylor, professor of history at UC Davis, has a new book out called The Civil War of 1812, and we have been talking to him about the new edition of Thomas Paine's Common Sense with an introduction by Alan Taylor. Alan, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
I'm happy to.
Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, and it's the most reliable way I hear to sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. Consider befriending us on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. And many thanks to Franklin Sterling, who's at the controls today.